This is Steve Miller, host of the podcast Book Artists and Poets, and it is Sunday, November 19th, 2006, and I'm sitting at the Gratz Park Inn here in Lexington, Kentucky, with Carol Blinn, the great Warwick Press printer. And Carol and I have been at King Library Press, the 50th anniversary presentations. We've both given talks yesterday, and we're both pretty tired right now. But I have forced Carol to sit with me to talk some about the work that she's been doing for lo these many years. 73, isn't it, Carol?
73 years?
1973.
It feels like 73 years.
You started your work in 1973.
Yeah, at Gahanna Press as an apprentice with Harold.
Can you talk about that a little bit with Harold McGrath?
Right, right. Oh, gosh. 73 was one of the many pivotal years in my life. In the space of a month, the company, I had worked for Barry Publishing Company and Imprint Society. They were two publishing companies in one. And we, our president had died, Alden Johnson, and the rest of us who worked at the company didn't have any money. You know, publishing is, it's basically digging a hole in the ground, throwing money in it, and then just, you know, losing it all. So we were going bankrupt, and my husband and I were having real trouble, and he went off to California to find himself. And so within the space of about 3 months, I lost my job. I got a divorce, so I took off in my little VW and stayed with friends in the country in Coleraine and kind of took care of some goats and made a garden and said, what in the hell am I going to do? And I had remembered one of the people who came to visit us at Barry was Leonard Baskin. I ended up driving to Northampton in my little VW and knocking on the door at Gahanna Press. I looked in the yellow pages for Gahanna Press. I had remembered that. And I knocked on the door, and Harold answered at 51 Clark Avenue in Northampton. And, well, I somehow knew I was home. And I was very nervous, and I said, could I have a job? I had no idea what I was asking for.
Had you had any printing experience? Or
Not letterpress, no. I had, years before I got to Barry, I had worked in an offset shop, and I had done, I used a little headliner for setting photographically printed, or, yeah, photographically printed headlines on a newspaper. I did a weekly newspaper, laid that all out, and the rest of the week we were, Wednesday we did the newspaper in Orange, Massachusetts, and on the rest of the week we were a job shop, offset. But I did little drawings, little blind drawings, and I learned, you know, like, compared to what I know today, I learned about 5 minutes worth of topography on my own. It was just one of these seat-of-the-pants, small-town, one-horse-town kind of newspaper job shops.
So that was the experience that you brought?
That was what I brought, plus my background in sculpture and so forth at Hartford Art School. But I just, my life had turned upside down overnight, and I thought, I want to get some different kind of job. So he said, well, I can't hire you. And he's talked about his boss, and then I realized somewhere along the line that his boss was Leonard. He said, but you can come in, and I'll teach you how to print. You can learn how to do letterpress. And so I made a mad scramble and realized I went to the unemployment, which for me, with my family, I mean, you always did, you took care of yourself, you never asked anybody for anything. But I found that I could collect unemployment insurance because of how things ended at Barry. But I was supposed to get a job. But those were different days then, so I did apply for other jobs, which I didn't get, but during that time, I was learning how to print. So after 6 months of working at Gahanna Press, and Leonard, when I first got there, he was in England, living in Lurley Manor near Tiverton. By the time he got back, and we had a long meeting, and they hired me. Harold said, you know, she needs a job. And then I got off unemployment and I worked at Gehenna.
What were you printing on?
Oh, I learned on the Thomson Laureate double flywheel, fabulous platen press, 14 by 22. Mm-mm-mm. It was, and you could disconnect, I never remember what it's called, underneath you could disconnect a bolt and you could double or triple or quadruple roll if you ever wanted to. It was fabulous. Or you could disengage the rollers and you could do scoring and die cutting without taking all the rollers off. Anyway, it was a beautiful, beautiful press. And then also the other press that I learned to print on, and it really, it's a one-man press, but Harold and I did a lot of work on it, was the number 2 Kelly, 23 by 35 flatbed cylinder. You know, every part moves, every part needs to be oiled. It smells good, it looks beautiful, it has a great sound. Lots of suction and air and tapes delivering, and I'd stand down at the delivery end and Harold would be at the feed end, and at first I was his fly boy and he called me Fly for short.
What were you printing at that time?
Let's see, we worked on one of the Shakespeare books that we did at Gehenna. We did a Coat Without a Seam, poems, a collection of poems, Stanley Kunitz. What else were we doing? Oh, gosh. We printed collections of wood engravings, of Leonard's, and we did a couple things for other people. I remember a couple times we did jobs for Sue Allen, and Sue was very meticulous about her ink colors. So she would come, we'd have lunch, and she'd chat and mix beautiful, earthy colors of inks to go on some of the illustrations that we did for her. The Thomson Laureate was the workhorse. We used that all the time. And when I was brought in, we formed the Meadows Press, which was, we called that the commercial adjunct to Gehenna Press. And there were people who were, you know, they always glom on to famous artists. So there were people who come in and say, oh, Leonard, would you have Leonard do a book plate for me or a wedding invitation or something? And Leonard would pick and choose if these were friends or people he liked and felt comfortable with. We had a collection of his blocks. And I proofed them all up and numbered them. And when he went to England, I gave him a copy of this so he could say, use block number 3 and this, and he would spec the type. And I or Harold would set it. And I was feisty. Before Leonard went to England.
Was feisty?
Well, okay. Okay, all right. I haven't changed much, have I? Have I gotten better? I'm riper. I'm riper and fatter. There were times when Harold would ask Leonard to sign some prints or some books, and Leonard really could have cared less. He didn't like numbering anything. He always thought, well, you know, I should do as many as I want, and there shouldn't be any limit. And, of course, collectors get apoplectic with that. They want number 2 every time a print is issued, so forth. So I can't remember what the prints were. He wasn't numbering them, but he was having to sign them. Maybe it was for one of the Shakespeare's. So I, as the little girl, you know, hireling, would put the print in front of him. He would sign it, and then I would take it away. And then so he didn't have to he didn't have to move much. And it's, I don't remember now, because, you know, she should have interviewed me like 20 years ago. He got ticked off about something, and I didn't suck up to him. And he just stormed out. He said, I don't have to take this, and he just walked right out. And I was like this, you know, twerp.
Standing Fly.
But I was, you know, don't piss me off. I'm trying to do my job here, too. So he came back a couple days later, and somehow we ironed it out. But you know what? I do know from that point on, he developed some kind of subtle respect for me, even though I was very young, because then I was probably 26, going on 27 maybe. Mm-hmm. And I realized, even being so naive at that point and young, that he hated people to suck up to him. He couldn't stand it. And the only thing he hated more was ignorance and making believe that you knew something that you didn't. So he taught me really clearly, if he was making some sort of literary allusion, or did I know something about something within history or whatever it was, if you said yes to Leonard, and then it was like an opening for him to sort of, you know, make sure you really knew what you were talking about. And so I would say, no, Leonard, I don't know who or what that is. Tell me about it. And then he was an extraordinarily intelligent, literate, fabulous teacher. And eccentric, but in his own way. And he was probably one of the most fascinating people I've ever known in my life.
How long did you work with Harold and Leonard Paskin?
So I went, I think Harold and I had our first talk in July of 1973. And I left in August of 75. Things had fallen apart at Gehenna. Leonard really was thoroughly involved in being in England. And I don't know enough about the finances. I know that when I first got to Gehenna and started helping, that I had to have a lot of contact with Mackenzie Harris and Helen Lee and Louis Mitchell and so forth. And that's when I realized, you know, people weren't closed-mouthed at Mackenzie Harris. There was a huge debt that Gannon had. So when we started doing Meadows, I started sending Mackenzie Harris money. I couldn't sign a check, but I could make everything out, and then our accountant would sign them. And so Mackenzie Harris people said, well, who is this, you know, whippersnapper in Massachusetts from Gehenna sending us money? I said, well, how much could we send you $50 a month for, you know, to try and whittle down this bill? And because of that, when I went out on my own, Mackenzie Harris said, what do you want to start?
Sweet.
It was, and I hadn't realized, and then I learned a lesson from that. And first of all, your word is the best thing you have. You know, you promise to people that you're going to follow through, and that kindness and good manners will help a person like me with no money get started in business. And so they were really, really good to me, and I sent them so much money. I said, I can send you this amount this, you know, month. And they said, whatever you want, and just pay us when you can. That's how I began. That's how I got type for my own shop. So, and there were business relationships like that that were just, they've lasted all my life.
So, okay, just before we get to Warwick, mm-hmm. could you just speak a little bit about Harold McGrath? Because he's somebody that I don't think a lot of people know about Harold. I met Harold first when he was printing with Barry Moser.
Okay.
And at that point, you know, I immediately recognized that this was a master printer who was a real gentleman, great sense of humor.
Yeah, he was. Well, I fell in love with him. He was, I still miss him. Having him die was, we had made a pact, of course more on my side than his, and I said, you know, you could never die unless we die together. That's about it. But he pissed me off and died first. He was extraordinarily gentle and funny, silly. He was a printer in the old style. He taught himself really how to print at Metcalf before Leonard used to hire him at night. Metcalf Printing was in the same building at Clark Avenue, and Leonard, I can't remember how he got to Harold's boss, but anyway, he did, and Harold started doing work for Leonard at night, started rubbing blocks at night, and then eventually Leonard got him to do some printing, and they ended up getting presses. I don't know how all the presses got there. I don't remember. I used to know, but I don't remember anymore.
When that operation shut down, did Barry Moser pick it up right away at that point? I don't know exactly how that worked.
There were Harold was deeply, deeply hurt that he felt that Leonard kind of left him. Mm-hmm. And there are issues on both sides that I don't know about. But Harold could take the position that, well, poor me, this has all been done to me, and, you know, waiting for something to happen. Those of us who loved him and were involved in things for a while, really, he didn't understand enough about other people's expenses and so forth. So anyway, I think basically Leonard gave the equipment to Harold, but Harold didn't know what to do. And then Jeff Dwyer came in and helped form Hampshire Tapapitai, and Barry was part of it. And by that point, I knew some things that were going on, but I was really so immersed in trying to keep my business going from day to day, because by that point, and I didn't see Harold a lot because he was getting involved and they were moving to Market Street from Clark Avenue, rearranging, you know, moving presses and getting their business going. And so they were all extraordinarily busy, and I was just trying to eke out my existence in East Hampton.
So what about that now? Why did you decide to strike out on your own, and what was the goal there? What was the purpose of your press in the beginning?
Well, I really didn't have a purpose other than to be on my own. So in July of 1975, I started looking around and thinking, well, God, I was so naive, and I just thought, well, gee, could I buy a building? I had $4,000 to my name, and at that time it seemed like a fortune, but of course it wasn't. I couldn't buy a building for $400, let alone $400,000. And anyway, so I found a little shop to rent on the main drag through East Hampton at 100 Cottage Street. And it had been used many, many years ago to display coffins. It was very long, 9 feet wide and 45 feet long. So I rented that, and I moved out of my little apartment in East Hampton to, there was another apartment in the building at 104 Cottage. It was right, it's sort of almost over in the same building, but over the shop. And by that September, I had gotten my 12 by 18 Kluge that I stripped for hand feeding, and an old double bank of wooden type cases, not much else, and I started to print. I had customers from Gehenna or Meadows Press, and I let anybody know. I mean, I knew a lot of people by then because of all the people who came in and out of Gehenna and Meadows. I lived hand to mouth for a long time. And there was a month where I kind of lived on sardine sandwiches. And then there was the next month where I lived on macaroni and tuna fish and celery and onions. And that's really good, like, for 3 days in a row. But after the fourth day, you know, just... I was doing business cards. I was doing wedding invitations. I was envelopes, letterheads, brochures, portfolios. And during that first, I'd say, 6 or 7 months, what I didn't understand, the rollers that I got with the Kluge were old, and I didn't have any money to buy new ones. But eventually, I kind of had to pay attention to these rollers, because eventually, as the press, and there are 4 form rollers and 2 inking rollers, when the press would be moving, the ends of the composition rollers would be flicking off, so I'd have little.
Oh, no. Oh, Lord.
I was covered with little flicks.
That's one sign, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a good sign. I finally paid attention to it. My first official little booklet that I published on my own at my own shop, I could never get the ink to be totally black, because I didn't get it that I was having an oil contamination problem. I thought it was just that, you know, I couldn't print on this, I can't remember what it was, Reeves or Arches or something, a little offcut that I had. So eventually I got new rollers and I solved the ink problem, and I printed almost every day. and all sorts of unusual jobs. I mean, I have a huge archive of all the stuff from that time, and on the rare occasions I've ever had to search through it, it makes me tired looking at it. I can't believe I did all that work, and now I feel like I'm lazy because there are many, 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 many. I can go a month now without printing sometimes.
At what point did you start to think about doing some of your own work?
Well, I always knew that was going to be sandwiched in between earning a living with commercial work. When I was at Gehenna, I did my first book there, my Song of the Cuckoo. I did a little booklet called Scalp Song and Other Poems, teeny little thing on American Indian. They were almost like haiku. I did The Understanding Eye. It was a quote by Stanley Morrison, and I cut my first capital W in linoleum and printed it as an initial letter. And I remember Leonard passing by. I never showed Leonard anything I did because he just scared the shit out of me. I adored him, but boy, did he scare me.
That's what I hear about him from other people.
He was easily intimidated. I still am.
He was an intimidating figure.
He was. And he had a certain kind of, his voice was, well, Carol, I can't do it well. I have other friends who do it really well. But he had this way, and I remember him, I would try to hide things. It was like being in school, hiding from your teacher, I knew I could set type really well and do certain things very, very well at Gehenna, but I did not show Leonard my work. But he saw this cap W and he said, "It's not bad, but it has mitten feet." And he meant that my serifs were a little too thick. I mean, I had one little wood carving tool, and the block was about, I don't know, an inch by an inch and a quarter, and I was struggling to make this thing. And so it became the W with mitten feet. That was Leonard's comment. But Harold was unbelievably supportive and generous with his time and expertise, and had the patience of Job, truly. Whatever I screwed up, I could, for Harold, it's okay, you do it over again.
Absolutely, it means nothing.
Exactly.
It's just a movement forward.
Exactly. Mm. So I did a number of small pieces when I was at Gehenna. So I always knew that that's what I wanted to do, and I viewed those as like dessert. Those things, little things I could fit in, but my main focus was on trying to pay my rent and trying to eat. And for years I never had medical insurance and that. But eventually, I mean, my little shop was cooking, and I worked all 7 days a week till late at night. And then I
Fun?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really heady. Although it was kind of lonesome but heady.
Mm-hmm.
And when that first fall when I went to work with Harold, after I did my Song of the Cuckoo, while I was sitting with these Inomachi sheets of beautiful paper that Harold had let me use or given to me, and he said, "Well, now we have to bind these." So he and I drove up, I think it was in September, October of 73. He drove me up to Pittsfield, and we spent a few hours with Arna Werner. And during that time, well, the rest is history. If you all had bought my book called Serious Play, you'd know the story of Arno teaching me how to make paste paper. So those two things happened within a space of 6 months. I learned how to do, began to learn to do letterpress printing, and I learned how to do paste paper, and I learned how to do basic binding with Arno Werner. So those two men, and then Leonard was this figure sort of on the outside of that circle, but he was still an important, extraordinarily important figure for his art and his expertise and his scholarship. So, but Arno and Harold, we all fell in love with each other, we really did. And Arno was in his 70s, I think he was 74 at the time I met him, and could work me under the table. So I'd go up there, I spent a week, and he said, "Ach, you come up here and you go." This is what he did with people. His generosity knew no bounds, as Harold's didn't. So I learned how to bind books and work in his garden, and I made pies, and we went out to supper, and he just taught anybody who wanted to learn. All you had to do was show a wheel.
Sweet.
He was extraordinary. So I would go up periodically once I had formed my own shop and go up and see Arno in Pittsfield. So we had a long collaboration until he died in 89, 91 maybe. So I kind of held him about 4 days before he died. He was lying on top of his bed and not fully, he knew I was there. I talked to him and I held him and I said, Arno, it's time to let go. So that was hard, but I miss him all the time. But I've been really, really fortunate. I've had extraordinary teachers, and what is a really healthy thing for me now is that I have students who come in and out and have tours, and I talk, and I do workshops, and I pass on all these wonderful things that I got.
I want to ask you about a couple of things. I want to ask you about your current involvement in your work.
What I'm doing now.
What you're doing right now. But I also want to ask you about the pecan duck.
Pecan.
Pecan duck. See, honey, the only way I can remember that.
You know, because we ate pecans last night.
The only way I can remember that is because of pecans.
It's P-E-K-I-N. Pecan.
What about these ducks?
Probably from Peking. Yes, actually. I think so. What about...
Because the ducks, I don't know when I first got to know you, but ducks were an image, a leitmotif that came up in a lot of your printed works.
Yeah. When I was 10, my parents, for Children's Day... Children's Day was something that we had in a congregational church when I was a kid. So they gave me these they probably were 3 or 4 days old, two little ducklings, which I promptly named, I'm so original, Debbie and Webby. And I just absolutely, positively fell in love with them. And they smelled so good. The smells are really important to me. I know, I sound like I'm really demented, but they just are so terrific. I met a couple other people who smell them.
You described it the other day as that hot duck smell.
Oh yeah, it is. It is a hot duck smell. There's like, they have, it's almost like they're little baby, they don't have little feathers, they have like baby duck fur, and it smells, they're hot, and their little bills are absolutely this beautiful little pinky orange when they're born, and they're soft, and you can hold them up to your cheek, and they just sort of nibble at you, and they peep, and they just are, you could, well, the only way, better way, if you could eat them. I mean, they just, they're so wonderful.
I think you probably could eat them if you wanted to.
Anyway, well, as you can tell, I don't talk about this very often because people really look at me funny, but they're just wonderful. And when you separate them, like even for 3 feet, and they make, and you're on a naked wood floor, and they go pat, 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 and they go chee, 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 and they hit each other, and they fall back. They just added a lot of joy to my life. I loved being around them. I loved having them sort of come over and nestle next to my legs when I'd sit out in the yard. And they were just wonderful company. And I'd talk to them in the morning when I'd bring them food. And I'd go, quack, 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 quack. And, you know, making believe that they understood me. So when I formed my own shop and was getting ready to print a letterhead, and a business card and an envelope, I did this little drawing, very realistic, but line drawing of Debbie. And that began my, oh Lord, how many years of hand coloring duck bills and feet.
Right, yeah.
I mean, maybe I did the hand coloring initially because I wasn't interested in paying for 2 blocks. For a color block for the orange and another block for the line. I don't remember now, but I loved the the repetition of painting piles of duckbills.
Oh yeah, they were beautiful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I still do it. I mean, my mailing labels still have, it's more of a cartoon-like image now. It's realistic, but only up to a point. And they vary over the years. Sometimes I'll have a whole row of ducks on the bottom of one of my many variations on my letterhead had probably 15 ducks on the bottom, and then I got tired of, luckily I didn't give them any feet, but I got tired of painting their bills. So, you know, now I'm down to one duck instead of 15. It varies a lot.
The excess of you.
Exactly.
Can you sort of describe what your shop is like now?
Okay. My shop is at One Cottage Street. After a year, I moved from 104 to One Cottage Street to an old, industrial elastic thread building, four and five story building where now, when I first moved in, I was the only tenant other than the landlord, which is a sheltered workshop for handicapped people called Riverside Industries. And then over the years, more people have come into the building, and it's really an extraordinary center. Dan Kelm is there, Peter Garrity, Sarah Pringle, Sarah Crichton, and until a year ago, and this is 2006 we're talking, Claudia Cohn was there, so we had great binders, and lots of potters, and musicians, and a couple printmakers, just really quite wonderful community of people. But we're all pretty solitary, and I am particularly where I am. People don't pass my door. I have my own entrance. I overlook the pond, Nashawanic Pond, downtown East Hampton, and I probably have maybe 3,500 to 4,000 square feet. The building is my floor is contained, so I have windows on all sides. Huge, old, drafty, unbelievably cold in the fall and boiling in the summer. I have a roof over me, so it's really that physical part is really hard. And as I get older, I'm less patient with that part. This past summer, which was our worst summer ever for heat, there were probably a month and a half solid where I couldn't be in the shop. It was too hot. And I'm not able to have air conditioning that can do anything because it's a brick building, all the windows, huge windows, and the roof. So once it heats up, it never cools down. My shop is loaded with not just my equipment, but I have, if I were to work with other people, they would make sure I was in one of those groups, they would have me committed to a group of Pile Makers Anonymous. I have issues with piles.
And you mean you have issues with them, or you embrace piles?
I embrace piles to the point where they're really awful.
I'm a member of the Southeastern chapter of Piles Anonymous.
Really? And in the last couple years, because I've really not had... I've not been doing the commercial work that I've done for years and years. I'm concentrating really on my own books and publishing. There are parts of my shop that I really don't ever use anymore. And, you know, you can wish for things, and then when you get them, you're not sure exactly that this is exactly what you wanted. Well, I do know that the pile thing, as Perry and I stand and look at my shop, he says, "Carol, you have a lot of shit." So, and what are you going to do with it, you know? So I know it doesn't mean much, but I'm slowly giving away things.
Can you tell me what you're working on right now? What project are you working on right now?
I love this. This is a book called Coincidental Pleasures, Printing and Farming. And it's an essay by Bob Barris of the Press on Scroll Road. He's in Carrollton, Ohio. And he had published this essay, or John Randall had asked him for something, in Matrix in 2003. And I've been a subscriber to Matrix from the beginning, so it's been really a wonderful publication, extraordinary piece of work. Reading the first paragraph of Bob's essay, and I did not know him, I knew that I wanted to publish this in a different form because I wanted to take it out and make it into something by itself so it would stand alone. So we have worked off and on, I'd say for the last year. I've had to do lots of other things that my huge serious playbook got done in between all this. So, but Bob's stuff, all of his text is set, and I've done line drawings, 5 or 6 line drawings of his animals and his press and his house and the press, the print shop. So that is cooking right now, and I'm really looking forward to getting that done.
That sounds
great. That'll be done this winter. Yeah.
How do you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's warwickpress.com. There are a fair number of ducks, you know, if people go to the site. It's very ducky. I want people to see a lot of color, see a lot of line drawings, read about the books. My list of publishing books is very eccentric, from, you know, poems about war to things about ducks, and I have a Once Upon a Time series that my alter ego Frieda Fitzenmeier does. So there's sort of something for everyone, a price range for everyone, and I keep doing new stuff. And I also do a catalog.
Carol, you know, I've watched your career over a long period right now, and it's always been really heartening to know that you're there in that space.
You.
I've been to that space. It's beautiful. In spite of the piles, and to know that you're working there solidly, coming out of letterpress printing, and you carry that tradition on just beautifully. And this is your time right now.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been fun being here in Lexington.
It's been wonderful.
Thought I didn't need no one, cause I was sure I couldn't find someone to love me. Despite my imperfections, they cruelly try to change me. They often misunderstand me until love completely estranged me. By the time you finally made it, those damaged goods felt so berated by the voices in my head telling me I must be no good. So that when your pure heart opened and your warmth entered me, I couldn't believe that I ever thought someone else could have done. You soothed me with your tenderness, and you hold me with your patience. And when I think I can't go on, you were right there. And I said, la 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 la. My fears, yeah. Now things start to get hazy. We both act all crazy. I must say those fragile words we do not mean. We both stop before wounding, and it's all so new to me that the scars heal from before I knew of you. You soothe me with tenderness, and you hold me with your patience. And when I think I can't go on, you were right there. And I said, la 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 la, and you helped me forget my fears. Yeah, you soothed me with your tenderness, and you hold me with your patience. And when I think I go on, you were right there. And I said, la 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 la, and you helped me forget my fears, yeah. And now when I want to fly away, and I'm sure that it's hopeless, you remind me with your existence that I could be right, but I could be wrong. Soothe me with your tenderness, and you hold me with your patience. And when I think I can't go on, you were right there. And I said, la 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 la.